Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. Tomorrow is Remembrance Day. And this year, as Australian troops begin withdrawing from Afghanistan, the day seems to have a deeper significance. Because, as you'll hear in our first story, there are clear parallels between the homecoming experience of contemporary Australian soldiers and the men who returned from World War I. The diggers who survived the battlefields of France, the Middle East and Gallipoli were considered the lucky ones. But the war left enduring scars on these men at a time when mental illness, especially war trauma, went undiagnosed. In the early 1980s, oral historian Alasdair Thompson began recording the stories of World War I veterans. The result was his book, Anzac Memories, Living with the Legend. It's been 30 years since it was first published, and as we sit on the eve of Australia's massive celebrations of the centenary of World War I next year, Alasdair Thompson has revisited his work. All the veterans he spoke to have passed away, of course, but this time around he had access to their medical records, and they are very revealing. Alasdair Thompson is speaking with Hindsight's Michelle Rayner. And first up, you'll hear the voices of the men he recorded on tape 30 years ago.
Australian Veterans of the Great War, Oral History Project. Interview with Mr. Percy Bird, conducted by Alasdair Thompson on the 8th of September, 1983.
I could tell you about somebody getting a bayonet shot through, but don't affect you much, does it? But if you were there and saw it happen, you can just imagine what you'd feel yourself if that was going into you.
Interview with Mr. Fred Farrell, conducted...
I had listened to the Prime Minister and his last man and the last shilling to defend the Empire, and the Premier, New South Wales, and the Archbishop, and I did what they said to do, and I enlisted.
A lot had changed. I mean, I'd been away overseas for 25 years. I come back to Australia. Anzac, which was already growing in the early 80s before I left Australia, had exploded in all sorts of ways, and not always sensible ways and ways that I was concerned about. So it's partly that. Partly Anzac Memories had gone out of print and a couple of publishers were interested in doing a new edition. And then I thought, well, actually, I could do something different. I wondered whether I should rewrite the whole thing. I thought, no, I'll leave it the book as it is. But I just thought, actually, several things have changed. One, the context for Anzac memory and the Anzac legend has changed because all the First World War veterans are now died. And so we've moved into a period of post-memory, which means you can't talk to witnesses, but you've still got their records in archives and so on. I thought, well, it's important to think about, you know, what role does oral history still have? What role do those memories still have once the guys are no longer here? So that was one interest. And the other was that new records have become available. When I was interviewing these guys in the 1980s, the repatriation records, the pension medical records that have been recorded by the Department of Repatriation since the war, since the First World War, right up until every man died, they were more or less available. They're still, you know, it took me the best part of a year to get access to the records of the guys I'd interviewed, but family members can now apply to the National Archives and get those records, and they are one of the most extraordinary sets of records for Australian social and medical history that's available. And in many ways, I think the uncovering of those archives in the next few years and the use, the mining of those archives, probably more than anything, is going to shift, possibly even transform our understanding of the impacts of war on Australians and Australian society. So the World War I repat records, medical records for Victoria alone, measure 3 kilometres of archive space. It's a vast collection.
Just to set the ground work, tell us what the repatriation department did and was responsible for and what its sort of contemporary corollary is.
Well, most of us nowadays would know it as the Department of Veterans Affairs, DVA, but it was called the Repatriation Department. It was created during the First World War by the Australian government as the department that would be responsible for returned servicemen and their families, for their care and well-being, for pensions, for soldier settlement, for all the sort of schemes that were set up. And, well, there's debates amongst historians about how generous and so on it was, but, you know, compared to many countries, it was impressive. But for many veterans, it was nicknamed the Cyanide Gang in the, between the wars, because actually, you know, you put in a claim, it was like taking cyanide because you'd never get it, sort of thing. Mm. So veterans came, the REPAT, as it became known, eventually, after the Second World War, when governments became more liberal with a small L and medical understandings changed, it became more generous. But between the wars, particularly when the Australian government was cutting back funding during the Depression, as Fred Farrell said, you had to have an arm off and a leg off to get anything from the REPAT. And they put iron grills up in the sort of reception areas because the soldiers, the veterans, were so cross with how they were being treated. Mm. The REPAT and the RSL were the two key organisations for returned servicemen in Australia. Mm. And, you know, that made a difference. If you did get a REPAT pension, you got free medical treatment, it made a huge difference. And, you know, the 100% REPAT. And the thing was that you didn't automatically get a pension. You got a pension if you were damaged, that you could prove the damage was caused by the war, and you got a proportion of the pension depending on how much the damage stopped you working. It was like a compensation for loss of work, basically. Mm. And, you know, it was pretty straightforward if you lost an eye or a leg or an arm, although it still had to be argued about. But for a lot of things like tuberculosis, nervous conditions, arthritic conditions and so on, as any veteran now will tell you, you know, how do you make that link between the war cause and whatever, and how do you assess the impact upon you? And so on both those grounds, these were always contested and challenged things. But the pension, if you got 100%, if you were TPI, totally and permanently incapacitated, between the wars it was slightly less than the basic wage, if for you and your dependents, so that you were consigned to the working poor. Basically, you certainly weren't well off, but you were better off than if you were unemployed without a pension in the 1930s when, you know, support from the government was incredibly miserly. So it made a big difference being able to get one of these pensions. And so, you know, if you felt like the damage you were suffering, as many did in the 20s and 30s, then the REPAT was the place you went. And there's big variations. For example, it depended on where you were, who the doctors were, what they believed, because the state of psychology and understanding mental health was contested and it was changing. Mm. And there were an awful lot of doctors who thought that, you know, it was, if you were suffering from mental health, it was because you had bad genes and poor mental character. Or perhaps you were physically damaged and that had caused brain damage. No, the developing of psychological understandings of post-traumatic stress takes a long time to happen and is contested all the way through.
Which is what makes these records, again, so rich.
Yeah, you can use the records to explore the transformation and understandings about mind and body in Australia through the 20th century as lived out by veterans and their families and the doctors. And you can read all the examination notes, all the claims, the written claims by soldiers, by their families. I mean, I've found my grandfather's files and, you know, suddenly my grandfather, who's suffering from nervous damage of whatever variety in the 20s and 30s, actually it's his wife who writes. He's not well enough. Mm. She writes these beautiful copperplate letters to the REPAT and then follows it up because she desperately needed a pension.
We did a march through London. 5,000 Australians were picked to do a march through London on Anzac Day 1919. Of which I was one, and eventually we boarded the Beltana at Plymouth in June and arrived back here in Australia on the 19th of July 1919. If anybody was to ask me now what was I like at that time, I would say that in some respects could truthfully be said, and I suppose this applied to many others, we wouldn't be the full quid. In other words, we weren't what we were like when we went away.
there are different types of medical people who relate to these veterans. They've got their own family doctor or their lodge doctor if they're in a friendly society, who's more independent. But the LMO, the local medical officer in Paran or down in Sale, Gippsland, is the first significant point of call, and you have to go to him to get a proper medical examination. And if there's something seriously wrong, you're sent off to one of the repat specialists who are certainly contracted. They're not, if they're not full-time employees, they're contracted by the repat. And you know, there's a lot of records that show that the government and the repat were saying to these doctors, you know, you can't, we've got to be really careful. And there's a strong sense that they often didn't trust the veterans. Now, sure, almost certainly there were some veterans who played the system, not surprisingly. But there are many others who had legitimate reason, cause for complaint, who were, you know, rebuffed time after time after time. And you can read, you know, read all of that in extraordinary detail. You can get the most detailed medical. Every medical record that was ever kept is there. Although, tragically, the big set of records that is mostly missing are the wartime medical records, because most of those were destroyed in London in 1919 by accident, which meant that a lot of the soldiers didn't have the record that would have been the clinching evidence.
Their evidence.
So there's bits surviving, but they're only scraps and, you know. So we, for Fred Farrell, who we'll come on to, I really don't know whether he suffered what you might describe as shell shock in the First World War. There's all sorts of circumstantial evidence that suggests that he probably was, but there was certainly not enough for the best part of 40 years for the repat to believe him, because the wartime records had mostly gone missing.
How were you physically and emotionally at the end of the war before you came back?
Well, I would say physically, I was 21 years of age. Physically, I would be reasonably good. I didn't realise it at the time, but I long since realised it, that I had neurosis that was not recognised in those days, and so we just had it. We put up with it.
What were the symptoms?
And that developed an inferiority complex. Plus, when I wanted to speak, I'd get that way that I couldn't talk. And I would stammer and stutter. That inside me, everything had got into a knot. I found out years and years afterwards that this was simply a nervous condition, and that once I controlled that, I was told how to do it, and I was able to speak like I am now. But at least for 20 years or more, I was handicapped terribly.
So what was it about one of your interviewees from the 1980s, this digger, veteran Fred Farrell, what was it about his story that so attracted you, I guess, to sort of interrogate more deeply through his repat file?
Yeah, look, there were three veterans that I focused on in Anzac Memories, and I focused on these three because they were very different. And Fred Farrell's probably the most different, and if you're looking for a typical digger, he wasn't. Fred was a country boy from a farm in the Riverina, didn't like farming, a recruiting march went past, he joined it, he's 18, his dad didn't want him to go, he didn't get on with his dad, so he joined the march. He was young, he felt pretty inadequate alongside all these big, tough country guys. But he makes friends on the march and he goes off to the war, reinforcements, I think, for the 55th Battalion, and ends up on the Western Front. And immediately, most of his mates start getting killed or wounded and disappearing. So he loses his friendship network and he gets sick a lot and he gets wounded and he possibly suffers shell shock. But he's a mess. He's a complete mess. He only spends 6 months out of 3 years at the war at the front. Most of it, he's back in England in hospitals and camps and so on, recovering from trench feet, rheumatic fever, a gunshot wound in the leg, possibly nervous damage and so on. And whereas a lot of soldiers identified with the army and with their mates, he felt increasingly alienated and inadequate, really, emasculated by the war. Although one of the things I discovered more recently is a set of letters that he wrote home in 1917, which suggested, no, actually, he still had a sense of bravado and so on in those letters. Maybe he was just trying to make his mum feel good. Hard to tell.
Through the letters.
Through the letters, mm. Yeah. So he comes back from the First World War. He survives, but he comes back. He's in a Randwick Repay Hospital for 6 months with trench feet. He gets put through a training, pretty inadequate training scheme. He's unemployed for a couple of years, walks the streets of Sydney, can't go back to the farm because his legs aren't good enough, doesn't really want to go back to the farm. Unemployed, eventually gets some work as an upholsterer, and he's in and out of work through the early 20s, and then he has a nervous breakdown or a mental breakdown or a physical breakdown. The records are, I can talk more about that, but he certainly has a breakdown. And he talked about it as a nervous breakdown when I interviewed him. He said it was like his guts were all knotted up, and he had a stammer, terrible speech impediment in the 1920s. He was anxious. He was a mess. And the Repat files confirm that. There's a big wodge of files in the mid-20s as he begins to suffer a whole range of different ailments, and his employers say that he's off sick all the time and his legs aren't good enough and he's just not well, basically. And he does get a pension for the feet and for a chest infection, but only 15%, which is hardly anything. And he's furious. And he decides he doesn't want to have anything more to do with the Repat. And then the thing that makes him different from not all, but a lot of other diggers, he becomes radicalised. He joins the upholsterers trade union, becomes a member of the Labor Party. Eventually, he's unemployed from the early 1930s onwards, joins the Unemployed Workers Movement and the Communist Party. And at this point, his understanding of the war is transformed by his new political understanding. So the First World War is a war of capitalist and imperialist rivalry between these nation states and soldiers like Fred are pawns in this bigger scheme of things. So he has this sort of political way of making sense of his war, but that sort of political story doesn't heal the wounds inside. So Fred, who'd, you know, come back from the war, he had nothing, didn't want to have anything to do with the RSL. But, you know, people who knew Fred at the time and the way he talks about it, he's still deeply troubled. He has nightmares, dreams. And as it emerged, he didn't go into as much detail in the interview, but in the Repat records, he's having breakdowns through the rest of his life. Pretty well every decade has another period in hospital collapsing for one reason or another.
Overall, what was the sort of general tenor of the exchange, the relationship, if you like, between the Repat and Fred?
It's pretty volatile. It's pretty nasty, actually, and it changes dramatically. So all through the 20s and 30s, the Repat, yeah, they're giving him little bits for some of the physical stuff, but they're really wary, and they don't like him. They don't like Fred. And what's really interesting, the doctors characterise vexatious applicants. In terms of their physical and mental attributes, so they complain about his whining voice and his big ears, and it's almost like he's a feeble specimen, which is a common way that the medical profession tried to understand people who were, you know, chronically unwell. Mm. It's their fault. It's not the war. So that was a Repat thing as well. And they didn't like him because he answered back. He gradually began to get a sense of authority through the labour movement. And he would tell them what he thought, and he would write long letters, and they would ask him, tell us what your complaint is, and they would say in the file, he went on for a long time about his life story. And, you know, I've read those things. So you read a lot of versions of Fred's war and its impact upon him in the complaints, in the claims that he makes to the Repat. And they're very suspicious. And when he first, for the first time in the early 30s, during the 30s, he begins to claim for nervous damage for shell shock, which he hadn't done earlier. I think probably because it was clear to most veterans that you had to have clear physical damage to get a pension. To begin with. That's what he put in for. But then, and it's not clear from the records, he may have seen a non-Repat doctor in the early 20s about his mental health. Not clear. He certainly did by the 1940s. But by the 30s, he's beginning to articulate his damage by the late 30s as shell shock, nervous damage. And this is well known, in Australian popular culture in the 30s, the sort of war-damaged, shell-shocked veteran. And he's beginning to pick up on that, and he's beginning to make claims for it. And then in the late 30s, that's what he stakes his claim on. He says, this is what's happened. I've been damaged mentally having these breakdowns because of the impact of trench warfare, of the terror and fear and emasculation of artillery bombardment on the Somme, basically. And the Repat says no. They send him to a neurologist, a specialist, several specialists in Melbourne, who assess him and write a 36-page report and basically say, you know, all of your problems, mate, are to do with your post-war life. You know, you've you know, you've got involved in the labour movement, you've been unemployed, you've separated from your wife and child, and so on and so forth. You know, there's no evidence here that this is war-caused. And so he's told no, basically. Mm. And he keeps on complaining and keeps on appealing through the 30s. But it's not until after the Second World War, not until late 1940s, when he actually puts in a claim for an ulcer, a duodenal ulcer. And there's a sort of common sense understanding that ulcers are caused by stress. And one of the doctors who examines him makes that connection and says that. Actually, nowadays we know that this sort of ulcer is caused by bacteria, not by stress. But actually, that's what both Fred and this doctor suspect. And in 1949, for the first time, a repat doctor says, it's a bit hard to know. How can we not say that there's not a connection between what this man experienced during the First World War and the ulcers that he's got now, the ulcer that he's got now, but also the range of physical ailments and mental breakdowns that he's had through his life. I think there's a core connection here. And bang, in 1949, shell shock is recognised, neurosis is recognised, and he gets a pension for it. Mm. Having battled since the early 1920s, almost 30 years later, he gets a pension for shell shock. And that's partly about changing medical understandings. It's partly about the repat being able to be more generous in a more affluent post-World War II society, and it's partly because Fred had been persistent and kept fighting, kept battling. You know, he wrote to Billy Hughes, he wrote to his, when he got involved in the Labor Party, he would write to Labor ministers who he got to know, get on his case. And not just for himself, the lovely thing about Fred's files, he starts complaining on other soldiers' behalf as well. He becomes a determined advocate. Mm. You know, the repat must have hated it when he turned up because he was so vociferous and you can see it in the files. You can almost hear them saying, oh, damn, Fred Farrell's back again. Spare us, sort of thing. But he was good at it. He was very good at it. And he, right up until his repat file in the archives is closed to researchers after 1983 because of the 30-year rule. But actually, Fred had kept his set of all the records and deposited them in another archive, so you're able to read up until he dies in the early 90s. And he's still battling. He's still having breakdowns. Mm. I mean, that was one of the other extraordinary things. I discovered that, a few weeks before I interviewed him for the last time in 1987, he'd just come out of Heidelberg repat having had a mental breakdown. He was still suffering.
Fascinating. So what did this research through these incredible records into Fred's life, this new perspective, how did it erupt or disrupt the understanding that you'd had and that you'd rendered in Anzac Memories of Fred Farrell's war story and his life subsequently?
Well, it both disrupted it and confirmed it. I mean, I started reading these repat records and saw what an articulate and purposeful and canny complainant he was, activist complainant. And I wondered, when I interviewed him, I was in my early 20s when I interviewed him, was I a naive young, I'd been on C&D marches and P&D marches, and was I a naive young peace activist who was being beguiled by this wily old veteran and taking in his mythology and recounting it? And in the end, I think mostly not. I mean, I actually think Fred believed what he told me, but I think the story that he developed, his way of understanding his war, had changed across time, which is really what I was trying to argue in Anzac Memories anyway. Mm. And what the repat records confirmed, really, is you could see how it was developing. It's not that, I mean, his war experience never changed, but how he understood it changed. And that doesn't invalidate his memories and doesn't invalidate them as a historical source, but it helps us explain the ongoing relationship between past experience and present understanding and meaning and identity. So you can see his politics beginning to change the way he understood his relationship with German soldiers, for example. You could see, as he listens to the doctors and argues with them and begins to get a handle on ways of understanding his mental health, he adopts a language of what we now call post-traumatic stress, what was called shell shock or neurosis, as a way of explaining most of his ills. Now, I think Fred had plenty of cause in his post-time life to be depressed and anxious. He had, Australian intelligence had a file on him from the 1930s, probably through the rest of his life. He got involved in some bitter disputes between left-wing unions and the industrial groupers in the 50s and 60s.
Unemployment?
He was unemployed for all of the 1930s. His marriage broke up. Whole range of reasons where, you could think this would have an effect. And it may have done. And I think it's probably likely the war also had a pretty negative effect on him in a range of ways. He's a young, impressionable guy who is physically battered by the war, mentally damaged, loses lots of mates. I mean, extraordinarily, he could remember in precise detail the exact date and place of death of every one of the guys he went away with, that sort of stuff. So it had really been imprinted on him. So I guess I ended up thinking, okay, yeah, he was war damaged, he was peace damaged, if you like, but in his way of making sense of it, the war was his explanation. And that had been an explanation developed with the repat to win a pension, but I think he became to believe it as well. So I learn about Fred. I learn about changing medical understandings across the 20th century. I learn about the power of the state on people's lives. I learnt, less so with Fred, but even a bit with Fred, how this isn't just about the veterans, it's about their families.
Well, let's lastly think about how you reflected then on oral history as a record, you know, as a source.
There's a paradox, I think, in oral history. Long-term memories, the science tells us, are remarkably robust. Our short-term memory is terrible, and most of what happens to us we forget within a few hours or days. But once things get storied and embedded in long-term memory, they're remarkably robust. They're robust, and this is the paradox, they're robust, but they're also malleable, because every time we return to those memories, we come from a different place with a different sense, with a different audience, with a different set of understandings, and we remember in slightly different ways. So Fred remembers the impact of the battle at Polygon Wood differently when he writes a letter to his mum 1 month later, when he tells the repat about it in 1930, when he tells me in 1983, because there's new ways of understanding. Both for him and in the wider culture, and because it means different things to him. You know, the impact of that battle means something very different in 1917 from what it means in 1927. We can use memory as an extraordinary resource to help us to understand the wartime past. And yet at the same time, we have to be, like any other historical source, we have to be aware of the way in which the source has been shaped by culture and individual motivation and so on. But also we can use it to understand the past, but we can also use it to try and understand the impacts of that past on people's lives through the rest of their life, both individually, Fred Farrell, and in Australian society. So if we're going to really understand the hold that the Anzac story, that Australians at War has in Australian society, then that's not just about what happened in 1915. It's just as much, if not more, about what's happened ever after, and the way in which both individual veterans, but also within families and in the wider society, we've struggled to make sense and to explain and to articulate what happened and what it means.
Walker sees the mist rise over no man's land. He sees in front of him a smashed up waste ground.
One of the loveliest moments of my life, I think, was when I landed off the boat and I drove in the gate at Sturt Street and I saw my mother and brother standing at the gate. That was one of my lovely memories. After being away and through that, and there she was standing at the gate and my little brother standing alongside her. Always, that scene, I always remember that.
P.J. Harvey with Hanging in the Wire from the brilliant album Let England Shake. That song actually references the World War I song that English soldiers used to sing about the officer classes called Hanging in the Old Barbed Wire. And historian Alastair Thompson was speaking with Michelle Rayner. You're listening to Hindsight here on RN, and today, personal stories and memories of war as we commemorate Remembrance Day.